You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 173.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
All right, and we're back. We are still talking about the fourth turning. If you are just tuning in, make sure that you listen to part one of this episode where we describe exactly what the fourth turning is. You can read all about it in this 1997 book by William Strauss and Neil Howe, which predicts or is supposedly predicts a lot of things that happen today. So, all right, let's talk about the evaluation of my evaluation of what this book says. So, we just discussed, what this book says, and I'm just going to give my current thinking on how, because this is clearly not, it's clearly not very scientific, I would say. Evaluate it because my, my Bayesian inference mind, my scientific method says, man, I don't know what to do with this.
Yeah. I was going to throw out as my first challenge here. How is this different than what like Nostradamus, type predictions, and granted, he's laid out a much more comprehensive kind of self-reinforcing theory here, but there certainly seems to be enough room for you can kind of make the evidence fit the theory. You can cherry pick a little bit when you're looking at history, and the proof would be in the pudding with future predictions. But is he making those kinds of predictions?
Yes, and there's a lot of things that happen. That sounds very prescient in the book, but there's so much stuff in the book and some of it just doesn't seem right. Or it seems like, yes, this is right, but you kind of have to tilt it around a little bit to say that it fits. That makes me a little bit nervous in terms of calling this book like a kind of Nostradamus. Well, no, Nostradamus in a good way. I like to say like, oh, it's like totally... it's totally predictive because it's clearly not. On the other hand, look, we're clearly in a time that's closer to what they describe as a fourth turning than what they describe as a first turning. That is for sure. So we're not living in a time of social conformity. And we're certainly not living in a time of individualism. So we're living in a time of crisis. We're not certainly not having a great awakening. Although they do kind of say that there are some similarities between an awakening and a crisis sometimes. So I feel like there are enough things that are right in here that I'm not going to throw it out as junk. I'll put it that way. And so I'm definitely going to incorporate this into my thinking, but I'll do it in a cautious way because I think a lot of it is narrative building. And the book also didn't have to be that long. Like it's 300 pages. I think we covered it in an hour and he goes into a lot of details about all of the different generations and how they're expected to behave and, different quotes from people in those generations. But I just feel like you could find so many quotes. It's not like that it's hard to find a boomer. Like you could find so many quotes by so many people, like almost anybody that could like fit your thing that it's hard for me to, I don't know, it's hard for me to see that as sufficient evidence.
Well, so I guess what would be the form of sufficient evidence to build this kind of a theory to back it up?
Yeah, I thought about that and I really don't know. I mean, it is kind of interesting that, a lot of historical thinkers have said the same thing, but Aristotle was wrong about a lot of stuff in physics, but fortunately we had a way to test physics. So this is really hard to test. I sort of thought, what data could I get to suggest this? One graph that I came up with was the debt to GDP ratio, which you could see in the Revolutionary War and the Civil War, the debt to GDP ratio goes up, and then it gets kind of paid off.
Now, do Strauss and Howe say anything specifically about that? Or no. You're just saying you're looking for 80-year cycles?
I'm looking for 80-year cycles, yeah. And then, of course, once you get the Federal Reserve, that thing goes off the rails, and now we're basically at the debt GDP ratio after the war that we're supposed to be in, but we're before the war. So that's
before the crisis.
Before the crisis.
There's no saying that it has to be a war.
I hope not. So that's my question. Is there anything testable in here? And I'm not really sure how you would test something like this.
I mean, this is a classic problem of history, especially, you know, social history like this, that the level of detailed, statistics and record keeping doesn't really go back far enough that you can make those kind of confident, highly supported conclusions.
Yeah.
You have to work from the available records, which presents challenges.
Yeah. Yeah. I also think, like, yes, certain things in history do seem cyclical, but can you have wartime and peacetime without a cycle? I mean, it almost seems like, and is it necessarily 80 years? I feel like some of their examples, it's kind of, well, sometimes it's 100 years and sometimes it's 70 years and sometimes it's less, but we're going to count that as an awakening, you know? So it's like, I'm not so sure. And of course they would say, well, yeah, it's history. It's not, you know, it's not literally the season, so it's not going to be exact, but it's like, but then how can you confirm the theory?
Right. It weakens the predictive power.
Yeah.
And I suppose there is value in being able to predict the trends, even if you can't predict the exact timing, but how much value, that's a tricky one to answer.
Yeah. So a lot of their predictions about the millennial generation also seem wrong. And I think part of that is they were looking to compare us to the greatest generation, but, you know, what a lot of the times they're comparing this fourth crisis to the World War II fourth crisis, but that was not very similar to the Civil War crisis. So why would they assume that this one is similar to the last one? So that I think is kind of a misplaced.
As they say in the market, past performance is no indication of future earnings.
Yeah. So what they said about the millennial generation is we've become very civic focused and we're team builders. We have a cheerful patience and we turn against entitlements / the old regime. I have that on page 295. And our crime is reduced. I actually think that's true until the last couple of years. But I don't know. Would I describe the millennial generation that way, having not read the book? I mean, I guess there's a way to push us into that.
I'm conflicted because I don't like to think of myself as a millennial, but...
Well, just talk about millennials in general.
Well, it's hard to do that accurately because it's essentially asking you to work with a stereotype.
Yeah. A renewed civic focus. I'm trying to think, like, what that is. I don't see, you know, I certainly don't see people having more confidence in their leaders. That's for sure.
I mean, I could interpret a renewed civic focus as people who are more involved with, like, nonprofits and being less focused on making money and more focused on making a difference and wanting their job to also save the world. I don't know if that's specific to millennials, but that definitely seems to be the stereotype that's a group that values that much more. Whereas Gen Xers are more kind of head down, make money, and I'll get my satisfaction through other venues, not through the nature of my work.
So that could be it. But I feel like that the civic focus of this generation is in totally the wrong areas. Like,
that could very well be true.
Yeah. So it could be like, all of the mask mandates and the lockdowns and, you know, making sure that nobody, everybody has the right opinions, all the woke stuff. Could that be specific?
I'd be very curious to see a breakdown by generational group of who's in favor of what policies there. I haven't seen that.
Yeah.
And I hesitate to make.
I mean, you're right. I don't know. Yeah. It's millennials being directed by prophets, just like they said it would. And again, it's turning badly.
The one that I have heard numbers on is that in general, and I don't know if this is specifically millennials or maybe more what we frequently call Zoomers, a a ease, a willingness to give up individual rights for collective benefit for greater quote unquote security.
Yeah, that's what we're supposed to be doing, and that does seem to be what we're doing. So I guess
that kind of fits into this.
Not me personally, here. But maybe I'm one of the people that gets emphasized at a different time. Who knows? or I could just be spitting into the wind. A big hit that they said that during this time, no one will be interested in teen culture, except to chastise anything that offends. And I agree. You know, this, what is teen culture in the year 2021?
Is that specific to a fourth turning?
Yes.
Because I feel like it's
what's just, teen culture in 1942?
That I don't know, but I feel like, you know, like during the rock and roll era, you know, yeah. I'm thinking of music in particular, that every generation has their new music, and everyone who's older than them thinks that it's terrible and the worst thing ever and stupid.
Yeah.
And I feel like that doesn't change with the turnings. That's pretty universal.
But they say that the music styles do change. The musical styles do repeat.
Well, but I'm saying that...
Not exactly, obviously. Like, we're not bringing back big band, but...
But in every turning, the generation older than you is still going to think that the youngest generation's music is terrible. And the youngest generation is going to think that everyone else is old fuddy-duddies. And that's not specific to whether you're in an awakening or a fourth turning or the high.
Yeah. I haven't heard teen music now. Like, what is it? I haven't even heard it. Like, it's I'm waiting to hear this music that I think is terrible, and I don't even know what it is. It never plays.
Yeah, I don't think so much about the music when I think about teen culture and things that are going to be trashized. It's exactly that. TikTok, Snapchat, right. Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, but I...
There's probably some new cool thing that I haven't even heard of because I'm too old.
The whole thing, like the chastise everything that offends, of course, is right on. But yeah, again, they have a lot of predictions about the previous fourth turning. These guys are very pro-government for fourth turning. Like, people rely on authority, and they're like, well, you should send your kids to public schools because, you know, that's where they're going to get the conformity to...
Strauss and Howe are saying that government is the solution in the fourth turning, or are they saying that people are going to naturally turn towards the government for
a little
solutions?
Bit of both. A little bit of both. They're like, well, you should go to public schools because that's going to, that's going to give you the social relevance and conformity and team building that you're going to need in the fourth and first turning. I think particularly for millennials, they're talking about, but maybe even into the fourth turning now, because you have to remember this is written in 97,
right.
But it's like, yeah, I don't think they realized how bad some of these public schools were going to get. And they do say children will be very pro-government, and, are children more pro-government today than they were, 30, 40 years ago? Again, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't even know what the metric would be we'd use to compare that. I'm sure there's some sort of surveys and studies that look into that type of thing, but I'm not familiar with benchmarks there.
Yeah. All right, let's look at some of the other predictions. So here's an interesting quote. I'm gonna bring out this quote because it's, I think, some of the best prediction was the one that he said wasn't gonna happen. Let me make sure I have this picture. Here it is. Right. So he's like, you can't just use the 1990s to project into the 2020s, because then you'll say something like this. The 2020s would be a mere extrapolation of the 1990s, with more cable channels and web pages and senior benefits and corporate free agents, plus more handgun murders, media violence, cultural splintering, political cynicism, youth alienation, partisan meanness, and distance between rich and poor. There would be no apogee, no leveling, no correction. Eventually, America would veer totally out of control along some bizarre centrifugal path. Now, not all of those things came to pass, but that wasn't as far off as he was...
That has the ring of truthiness to it, if I ever heard it.
I feel like...
And he was specifically saying... It would be wrong to predict this.
Well, I mean, I think part of our problem was, we maybe if the 1990s were an unraveling, we just kept on unraveling. And so they say if the crisis comes sooner, like it did in the Civil War, it can make the crisis worse. So maybe not. But yeah, I feel like if you unravel for too long,
we're supposed to be firmly in the crisis period now, and we still haven't.
We are
distinctly identified what the crisis is.
Well, there are lots of them. The problem is none of them.
Are resolving the issue a true fourth turning. It needs to not just be a big old crisis. It needs to then resolve to something that allows the ascension into the
nothing hospital. Is able to unite the country and put the country back together. But look, in the Civil War, you had to do that by force. And I feel like maybe if 9/11 came in the fourth turning, then the country would indeed unite around that. Although now it seems like maybe we wouldn't. So I don't know.
So we really need to just be holding out hope for aliens.
Yeah. Well, I mean, hopefully not. Do you really think that those UFOs are aliens, by the way?
I haven't even looked into the latest round of things.
I think that there could be extraterrestrial life out there somewhere, but I think these UFOs are probably just either technology or illusions.
I think my favorite recent take on that was, and I realize it was from a satirical site, but it was, NASA announces that extraterrestrials may not be sufficiently sexy to mate with humans. So it's either someone's being very pessimistic or just not trying hard enough on that front.
All right. So another point that some people have made, and there's a blog post on this and also an episode on this in the What Bitcoin Did podcast, which I will link to as well. Let me write this down. What Bitcoin Did podcast.
The host of whom you have had on the show previously, I believe.
Yep, Peter McCormick. And I don't remember who the guest was who talked about this, but basically they were saying, yeah, one of the institutions that is unraveling and failing is the institution of money in this country. And now you have each successive administration printing, let's say, double of what the last one did in increasing the money supply. And it's becoming increasingly kind of funny money. And what that does is that gives certain people in the economy a very unfair advantage. It increases wealth inequality. It basically, because, you know, inflation on its own doesn't hurt you. Like if everyone who has $10 now has $100, every contract, you just 10X everything, you add a zero. That doesn't change your life at all. The problem is some people, when there's inflation, the political class essentially, and the big corporations get that money first. And so it kind of sucks value out of the middle class and the people who are low income who are trying to save, basically. So they're like, well, we need to have sound money, and we need to build a new system based on sound principles that is that is the new institution that'll create the first turning. And he's like, well, Bitcoin was invented just at the dawn of the fourth turning. Maybe that's not a coincidence. So I mean, I like that theory because that's the one theory that says that this fourth turning is going to turn out well, and that, you know, the winners are going to be the good guys, essentially. But what do you think about that
theory? So yeah, if the crisis of this fourth turning is an economic one,
it seems like it's been
the money supply.
Yeah.
What might the tipping point, the final crisis there be that causes us to resolve the conflict?
Hyper Bitcoinization. Basically.
But I feel like something has to trigger that to happen, something dramatic.
Yes.
And I'm having trouble picturing what that could be. I suppose if I could picture it, then I would be a savant. You know, I'd be able to see the future. So it shouldn't be surprising that I can't. But
okay, let me put it this way then. It starts with out of control inflation, let's say, and the government goes through several upheavals, and finally, after like 100 years, you get someone in there who says, we're going to resort to sound money, and instead of fighting this Bitcoin thing, we're just going to accept it and put it on our balance sheet, and that'll be that. That's our money now. And then that's something that everyone can get behind, because even though Bitcoin is sometimes tarnished as, like, I've heard Bitcoiners tarnished in the way, you know, our political debates is like, oh, so-and-so is a racist, so-and-so is a horrible person. And people try to do that with Bitcoiners too, sometimes well-deserved, like, you know, not as some, there are scammers in there, you know, whatever. But I think in the end, people are just going to realize this is just math and it's objective. And after all the craziness that we've been through in the 2020s, let's say it's like 2028 now, it's just like, this is the only thing we could trust because all the other institutions have failed us. So, yes, I think it's hard to say. I guess I didn't give you the exact answer that you wanted.
Well, but I think the thing that you got to that's helping me flesh it out in my brain is it would not be a purely economic, you know, that because, I mean, nothing happens in a vacuum. So in order for this to happen, there would be all sorts of other upheaval and crises that go along with it. So you said, you know, a lot of turnover in leadership and government and crises there that maybe are a result of the economic factors here, but it's not like something's going to happen purely on, you know, on Wall Street and at the Fed and the Treasury that all of a sudden is going to tip this over. It's going to involve all aspects of society.
Yeah.
And you know, whether or not that involves rioting in the streets and literal spilling of blood or not, is TDB to be determined, but it could very well.
Yeah.
Just because it's economic doesn't mean that that's all off the table.
Right. But it actually could end without all that stuff. I mean, it seems like some of that stuff is going on like as we speak in the last few days, but hopefully not in a large scale. So I'm going to link to that because that is a fascinating idea. Another one. So what does this mean for the 2020s? When does the fourth turning end? It's hard to say. If we are coming up this year on the 80th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. So I think that the Saeklum is usually a little longer than 80 years. I think from Pearl Harbor to the start of the Civil War was almost exactly 80 years, but I think that to the start of the Revolutionary War was maybe a little bit more. So let's say it's 85 years. So maybe we have 5 years until we have that big event. Okay. We could be in the years of the run up to, or it could just happen this year. You know, we don't know. It could happen tomorrow. Right. So if you're going by the 80-year cycle, like their example here was like, hey, Catalyst happens in 2005, which people are now claiming, oh, that's the housing crash. I'm not sure.
Was that actually 2008 was when the crash happened?
Yeah, 7-8. And then they're saying, oh, the climax happens in 2020 and the resolution 2026. And you might say, coronavirus 2020. But I'm not so sure. I'm still open to the idea that it hasn't happened yet, just because I feel like we are still, like, there's still not, we're still jumping from thing to thing. Every few months, I feel like there's another big thing to be outraged about that everyone's going crazy over. And the fact that people don't have a long media attention span, and, you know, it's all like, you know, 1 week we're hearing January 6th, that's all we're going to hear about for the rest of our lives. And now it's like, you know, wait, what happened that day? You know, or COVID. You know, we're going to defeat this like World War II. Biden is really into that. Like, this is this generation's war. Well, now that we're all vaccinated and, you know, people don't have to yell at each other about masks and elevators anymore. Like, people are screwed up now. So what happens when they get together? But I think it's going to be something else. I don't know. I feel like all this is definitely leading up. I'm still waiting for the other shoe to drop. I don't know about you.
Yeah, even if somehow we could wave a magic wand and, you know, COVID was wiped off the earth, you know, no one ever had a confirmed case ever again, that doesn't feel like it would be a segue into a first turning.
No. No, because our institutions have not been rebuilt.
Right.
Yeah.
If anything, they've just been further weakened.
Exactly.
So something else needs to come along to fully break them.
And it does feel like something will, because the path we're on now is not sustainable. Like, one of the things that I say, okay, maybe maybe this new ideology, like it's called whatever you want to call it, the woke ideology, maybe that wins the fourth turning. Is that sustainable? Does that sustain into a first turning? Could you have like a woke 50s? I'm not sure it's sustainable in that way, but maybe it is. I don't know. Maybe we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I haven't given enough thought to really wrap my head around that.
I mean, it's partially a horrifying thought, but you know, I don't.
Well, so
I don't think that's what's going to happen.
I'm tempted to think about the Russian example. And so you said before that they're kind of out of phase with the rest of Europe and certainly
right.
with America. But if their fourth turning was the Russian Revolution in 1917, then would the 20s and 30s have been their high? I feel like not so much, because I think they struggled pretty hard in that period.
Yeah, I mean, it's Russia.
Yeah, I suppose if they weren't struggling, it wouldn't be Russia. That's a fair assessment.
Yeah,
because they didn't really seem to get their stuff together until maybe the late 30s, and then they got slammed with the war.
Right. Yeah, I guess you're right. But then, of course, I feel like there was a fourth turning in Russia, followed by another fourth turning elsewhere in the Soviet Union. That kind of
A 1-2 punch of fourth turnings.
Yeah, they got a 1-2 punch of fourth turnings. That's a good way of putting it. And so I think that could happen, especially when you have lots of different societies interacting that are all out of phase. They say here that it doesn't work for other countries, which again, it kind of weakens. They have a plausible reason why it doesn't, but it also kind of weakens the theory. So,
yeah, I didn't read that section, but how much of that was kind of on the American exceptionalism, Anglo tradition lines,
No, it's more like the self-contained, non-contaminated type thing. And some of the earlier fourth turnings in British history are also very interesting, like Spanish Armada's coming to get you, and you have to beat that. And then there's like the War of the Roses was before that. And all I know from the War of the Roses is it was basically like Game of Thrones, and you had
indeed,
you know, Tyrion in there sending dragons. And I don't know.
So how did the I guess it was the tail end of the fourth turning in France was so there was the French Revolution followed by the Napoleonic era, and that was all lumped together into their fourth turning and ending in, like, what is it, 1815, when they get rid of Napoleon?
Right. And that was during our first turning, which was
our post-revolutionary high.
Yeah, it was like so we had a long first turning there. It was like the constitutional era. So it wasn't really a 1950s. You know, again, so it's not always like 1950s. It was like, okay,
And it wasn't without war, because we had the War of 1812 right in there.
That's a great example of a first turning war.
Yeah,
a perfect example of a first turning war. It's just it confirms the previous result.
I guess that does make a good analog to Korea.
Yeah, yeah. But it wasn't like the 1950s. It was more like, okay, you know, we have this crazy fourth turning. Institutions are being built. You have the Articles of Confederation and all that. And I think that the Constitutional Convention would have been like the first turning.
Yeah, I think they mark that as the end of the fourth, the beginning of the first.
Yeah, yeah. And so now you have a stronger central government with George Washington and the Federalists. Now, they also count the era of good feelings, which is like 30 years later, as also part of the first turning. So maybe you have a really long first turning, or, you know, maybe they had part of the awakening bleeds into that era of good feeling. I don't know. Again, it's the right. So the timeline gets a little bit off. But definitely, like, I mean, my knowledge of American history, you know, again, I have strong opinions about, like, political stuff that's going on now. When I express an opinion about stuff that happened hundreds of years ago, I am way more open to changing it just because I know so little about it. But my feeling is, like, once we get to Andrew Jackson, things are very different. And that's sort of where I think, like, I'm actually very, I sort of recognize Thomas Jefferson's party as the left-wing party of its time, but I'm very sympathetic toward that party. I think that was one of the few eras in the American history where the left was good or even better than the other party. But
right. Well, and Jackson is generally seen as the turning point of that. Yeah, that was the end of the Democrat Republicans. In the sense that Jefferson would have known them.
Yeah. So I think, and interestingly enough, most of the times in history where I think the left were the good guys were first turnings. So that's kind of interesting. But we can go into all of that. So maybe in 10 years, I will be a staunch Democrat.
So how does FDR fit into that?
Well, he was fourth turning,
right?
Yeah.
And I mean, would it be incorrect to refer to him as left?
Yes.
I would
the Democrats at the time were the left party, yeah. I would say I'd be more sympathetic to, like, Kennedy in 1960.
And I guess that was the tail end of, of the first turning.
Sure. And even Truman tried to have another New Deal type situation, but didn't have the
capital to make it happen.
Look, there are also a lot of problems during the first turn. I mean, I guess Eisenhower was pretty good, but you could also point to, like, every president in American history could point out, like, I know, like, all the libertarians are listening, like, look at all the bad things all these presidents did. And I get it. But it's just a comparison thing.
The implication, it's implied when we say president that they did terrible things. We don't have to say it explicitly every time.
Yeah. But you could also say, you know, some were better leaders than others. And this book is, these people are, like, pro-government. Like, they live in D.C., so I understand what it's like to write for, you know, sometimes you're writing for the people in power to say, hey, check this out, where it's like, and by the way, I think you could still have a theory of this where it's like, you know, these are more about social attitudes than about, like, you don't have to give up your political point of view just because it's a different turning, but you can adopt your political point of view. Like, you could be a libertarian in a very individualistic time, or you could be a libertarian in a very conformist time. It doesn't matter in terms of, like, you know, the use of force against individual rights.
But you will likely be fighting different specific flashpoint battles on the political front there.
Exactly, and you'll definitely tailor your message very differently. Same for conservatives, same for liberals, all that. So, and that's one of the lessons they give, which I think is kind of important to understand. It's also, if you're not into politics, it's true for marketing campaigns as well. I mean, actually, one of the interesting ones was, there was a trend where the movies that were popular about demon children.
So, like, The Exorcist what was the one with Damien?
And that must have been during, like, the second turning. Yeah, that was
The Awakening.
Yeah, yeah. That's when Gen X was growing up and being ignored. You're like, demon children.
Was that also when the big D&D scare happened?
What's that? I don't know.
Oh, the Dungeons and Dragons. And there was a moral panic about, it was, like, actually, like, dark magic, and people were getting, like, people were basically being tricked into committing suicide or murdering people. Yeah, crazy stuff. But people believed it back in I don't know if that timeline matches up with the Awakening. In the what would have been late 60s, early 70s.
So by the millennials came around us, and all of a sudden they like kids again, is what the book is saying. So the culture hated children. Sorry, Gen X. I actually think Gen X is going to save us in all this because they seem to be the most they seem to be the most sensible. But anyway, and I think I have more in common with Gen X than millennial as well, even though I'm a bit younger. But the point of that was, okay, all these movies come out about demon children, right? Way up to Problem Child or whatever in the 80s. Then the third turning rolls around. Now, do you think those, the people making the movies, do you think they were saying, well, all of these movies about demon children are doing really well at the box office, but I think the times are changing. Let's stop making them. No, they didn't. They kept making them. But the interesting thing that happened was they stopped selling. People didn't want to go there anymore. And it's, so it's not like people willfully decided. It was consumer trends. So this is not just about selling politics. It's about selling consumer trends as well. And I thought that was an interesting example. And so then all of a sudden, in the popular movies, children became the good guys. I'm trying to think of an example of that, but I don't know. Okay, so what else? What else does this book say? Adapting to the changing times.
Did we talk about The Grey Champion?
Oh yeah, I missed The Grey Champion. Right. So The Grey Champion is Obi-Wan Kenobi, Gandalf, Moses.
The wise mentor.
Yeah, from the prophet generation. And generally it's a political leader that comes along that the heroes kind of grab onto. And I look around and I don't see one. But it's clear that the millennial generation does like to latch on to really old people. So you got that right. Anywhere from, let's start with Ron Paul. But then, of course, Joe Biden and Trump to an extent. Bernie Sanders. Of course, Bernie Sanders is in there.
So would this be part of...
Dr. Fauci? No. I'm not just saying, I'm not saying I like all these people. But I'm saying, yes, I feel like there's a sort of a yearning for this old guy as the paragon of leadership, which is it's kind of glorified in the past. Where's our Winston Churchill? Or if in the UK example, but I mean, okay, I know I'm not going to go through and I know I'm going to be accused of everything for bringing everyone up, but you know what I mean. Okay. So it's sort of but none of these leaders tend to stick.
Yeah, so in we certainly saw in the last round of presidential primaries that it seems, and maybe Gen X just isn't old enough, but it seems like there's no the young bench of politics is failing to get people to the fore, and so we're ending up with people who are. Much more seasoned would perhaps be a generous way of putting it, and recycled would be a less generous way. That they've been through this and they haven't cut the mustard before, but they're what we've got left now, and so we're going to go for them.
Yeah. So I don't think we have the great champion. They paint FDR as the quintessential great champion that comes in and changes the whole political system. And then it's yes, some people are saying that that's what Biden's doing now. But I don't see it. But I guess we'll find out what people are going to say we'll know in a few years, don't we?
Yeah, I'd have to think of the analogies to who I would more accurately draw the lines from Biden.
They could also be fairly authoritarian. But... Which I guess a lot of leaders are these days. So, when they talk about the type of great champion leader, I see some of Biden and some of Trump. But I don't think they either fit the bill entirely. So we'll see what happens. It could just be an archetype that doesn't show up or shows up late.
Well, so I hesitate to do this, but since I already Goodwined us in part one of the episode.
Yeah.
Would Hitler have been a great champion for Germany? What generation does he fit into?
No, he was not a Gen X.
He was a nomad.
Lost generation. Oh, yeah, authoritarian. Okay. Yeah, they say that could have happened too. You could get an authoritarian type from that generation, but that's not the great champion. But sometimes you can get a leader from kind of the middle-aged generation. What was a good example of that? So it's sort of a good example, almost the opposite of Hitler, would be like George Washington.
Right, because we were talking about this before we started recording, that even though he was active very much in the same era as Jefferson, that he was a generation older, that he was, you know, Jefferson was very much a young man at the time of the Revolution and the Declaration of Independence, whereas George Washington had already had a military career behind him. He'd fought in the French and Indian War during the Third Turning.
Right.
And so he was the elder statesman. He fits this, yes, this great champion role.
I believe he made a mistake in that war that kind of kicked off a world war. It's like, oops. I think who would be in the prophet generation there? Maybe Ben Franklin. I'm just not sure. Actually, they've got a list here.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, he's certainly depicted as being significantly older. His old man womanizing in France days as ambassador.
Okay, so
It's tough to judge sometimes because completely
yes
on a tangent here.
Benjamin Franklin, Sam Adams.
Okay, yeah.
And Crispus Attucks.
Really?
Yeah.
I never think about how old he is because he's most known for being killed.
Yeah, so he would have been. Oh, I thought he was like a young guy. He was the guy.
That was my impression.
He was the first guy killed in the Boston Massacre.
I believe so. Yeah.
So he would have probably been. Well, I don't know exactly.
Was Boston Massacre? Was that
1760s?
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say I thought it was before the 1770s, but I couldn't remember exactly which year.
But they say born 1701 to 1723, so he could have been like 40 or 50. Okay. So. Yeah, I guess, I don't know. The great champion thing is interesting. He spends there's a whole chapter on that here, but I just don't see it as relevant these days other than to understand why millennials are voting for very old people or looking for very old mentors as kind of
are there people of that generation who are prominent outside of politics?
Yeah.
Like, I'm assuming that
so they'd be boomers.
Are like Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos, those are boomers, right? Or
Bill Gates is. Jeff Bezos might be a little younger. I feel like Jeff Bezos might be more Gen X, but I'm not sure.
Obviously, and I'm completely blanking on his name, but Facebook. He's a millennial.
Yes. Let's just call him Mr. Facebook. I don't need that name on my podcast. Tim Apple, Tim Cook.
Well, because you mentioned his predecessor,
right?
And being from the prophet generation.
Yes. Yeah.
Steve Jobs.
But I feel like he's an example of an entrepreneur who put the awakening to use, if that makes sense. No, I think it does make sense. He put the awakening to use by infusing spiritual ideas into technology. Let's put it that way.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, okay. Steve Jobs is a very interesting character. I can't say, you know, he didn't seem like the nicest boss in the world, but honestly, kind of a brilliant thinker. I'd sort of be interested to know what he would have to say about the tech trends of today if he were alive, not just what's happened at Apple, but just like the nature of work, the nature of big tech. I don't know what he would have, what he would have to say about it, it's sort of something that I think about sometimes. But yeah, I think your question remains. Like, there doesn't seem to be any obvious answer. And because people are living so long, like, we're supposed to be in the middle of the crisis where the boomers are the oldest generation, but you still have, they're like, oh, the silent generation kind of falls away. Like, no, we have a president in the silent generation. We still have lots of people in the silent generation who are highly influential. The I was going to say the Koch brothers, but I think there's who's the one that's remaining? I think David Koch passed away.
Oh, yeah, I'm not sure.
The other Koch brother is still around. George Soros, all those people who are Silent Generation. Even like Charlie Munger, who's commenting on Bitcoin and saying how he doesn't like it. Very wealthy billionaire from Berkshire Hathaway. And I was going to comment on Reddit, like, someone's like, that's boomer thinking. I'm like, he's too old to be a boomer. He's a silent. And I was like, no, he's older than that. He's, he's part of the GI generation. Oh, so he's like 97 years old. It's like, yeah, okay. Well, I mean, even if he's wrong, it's pretty cool that, he's part of the World War II generation and gets to comment on Bitcoin. But still, it's like there are so many elderly people, even older than they're supposed to be, who are very influential in our society that might be kind of screwing up the script a little bit.
So I want to come back to the Great Champion thing in just a second, but your mentioning of that with and also I think previously you talked about, kind of the measuring of the oldest person you know who influenced you being a measure there. It reminded me there's a tidbit, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but there's like a trivia question about when did the last Civil War widow die?
Right.
And it is far, far further into the 20th century than you would have thought, because it was a guy who fought in the Civil War relatively young.
Yeah.
And then late in life, he married a young woman. And so, when he died, she then went on to live like another 50 years beyond that. And so it was well into the 20th century that the last Civil War widow died.
No. Not
it's even more than that.
December 16th, 2020, this year.
What?
Yeah. Helen Viola Jackson was the last surviving widow of a Union soldier and the last surviving widow of a Civil War veteran overall. She died on December 16th, 2020, at the age of 101.
Okay, so that's even further than I thought. But it just goes to show that with slightly longer than average lifespans, you can stretch that from the beginning of one life to the end of another life that it directly impacted pretty far.
Right. And it makes you kind of think about like history in a more interesting way. Like they point out, like, think of the oldest person you know, and then think of the youngest person you're going to know and how long they're going to live. That's going to span, let's just assume lifespans are similar. That's going to span longer than the time that the United States has been around.
That's pretty mind-boggling.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, if for me, if I talk about, I knew someone who's born in 1899, he could have, he could have met a Civil War veteran easily.
Oh, almost certainly. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess there were people, there's video from the 1950s of someone who is being interviewed who witnessed the Lincoln assassination.
The assassination.
Yeah. Yeah, at age four, and he's there on TV in 1850. And during the Civil War, there was a journalist who was interviewing people who met George Washington.
That's mind-boggling.
So it is, yeah. It makes you feel like, oh my God, this stuff is a lot closer than And I think about this in genealogy too. Like you could really pass this on. You can kind of. It's almost like, in finance, there's the concept of leverage. You could take your lifetime, but also kind of leverage that up so you have you can expand before your life and after your life and kind of bridge the gap, if that makes sense. I know that wasn't very specific.
So let me pull us back in here. Okay. The great champion. Did we say already that FDR was a great champion?
Yes.
So how does the New Deal fit into that? That occurred in a fourth turning. The talk about is our fourth turning going to be like the previous one? Why might it not? But the obvious conclusion to jump to there might be something like the Green New Deal, but primarily because it's explicitly invoking FDR. But
and they say in this book the next New Deal.
But who would be the champion of the Green New Deal? Because if it's
Biden.
okay, maybe.
Look, that's one way things could work out.
I was going to make the point that Ocasio-Cortez is certainly not of the right generation to be a great champion.
No.
Is she X or is she millennial?
No, she's the younger. She's millennial.
She's a millennial. Okay. Yeah. So perhaps she is. She's one of the soldiers on the ground marching to Barden's great champion orders there.
Yeah.
In that metaphor.
I hesitate
to see him as the champion of something like that. But maybe maybe history will tell it differently.
Yeah. I mean, we. I feel like we can go into the question here of like who wins the fourth turning. Because I feel like these days, there have almost been like three or four times where one group has been like, that's it, we did it, we won the fourth turning. And of course, they don't put it in those terms. Although Steve Bannon, Trump's advisor when he was running, was into this stuff. But apparently Trump wasn't interested or wouldn't have it. But anyway, we've heard a lot about like, you know, we are on the right side of history. We'll win the future. We'll be in power forever. And I think by power forever, they don't mean forever, but you know, take the Civil War, for example. Yeah. Slavery is abolished. There's some backsliding after that for sure. But like, come on, the change is massive. And same with the New Deal. But now we have, Obama comes in 08. There's like, this is permanent. And the backlash happens like almost immediately, like a year in. And, you know, the same happens, same happens with Trump. It looks like the same might happen this time. I don't know.
Now, when you say backlash, you're talking about, you know,
political
flipping of how houses of Congress in the midterm.
Yeah, yeah, but it's just like a stymie of, you know, one thing is popular, then it's not popular, then another thing is popular, then it's not popular, and there's no goal to work towards, and it's almost like we're. It's almost like we're on a Wheel of Fortune or some crazy game. Like, where will the wheel stop? That's where you're going to live with. Where will the wheel stop? But
and we keep thinking it's going.
Yeah.
So like right now, the impression is that things are so close to a 50-50 split in what people want.
Yeah.
That it's easy to oscillate back and forth.
Yeah.
Presumably, the conclusion of the fourth turning, something will occur that causes the populace at large to coalesce around one of those two world views. And so it's not going to be a 50-50 split. It'll at least be enough that there's a solid majority for something moving forward so that the restructuring of institutions can occur rather than ping-ponging back and forth between, you know, every administration kind of rolling back the changes or improvements of the past one. I don't know what that is that causes that, whether it's a shift of people from one side to the other or a redrawing of what the paradigm is. But
it's, I mean, and I think Democrats will not like what I'm going to say, but they're going to understand what it's going to hit too close to home, where it's like the Democrat side of the aisle, the left, keeps on thinking they're about to win it. We're about to get that permanent majority, and then it turns out, that just didn't quite happen this time. Next time we'll get it. And then it's like, it must be very frustrating for them because they don't, because it hasn't quite gotten there. So I feel like there has to be, that's turned off. That's all right. I feel like there has to be some kind of a resolution there.
Right. There's predicting the inevitable and it never quite surfaces and that can't go on forever. Something is going to, like you said, the other shoe has to drop eventually, but we just don't know what that's going to look like.
And that's why, you know, something involving the crypto economy, Bitcoin, but also the decentralization of big tech and all of that could be a big part of it because it's a little bit less partisan and, you know, maybe it's a direction we can go in where people are not going to be so dug in and divided. I don't know.
I wonder if that's almost diametrically opposed to, because the path out of the fourth turning into the first turning is conformity, and it almost sounds like a coalescing of government power. That seems the opposite of what you were proposing there, but maybe that is something that a new consensus could coalesce around.
Right. It could be. It doesn't have to be a conformity of government power. It could be just more of a just a kind of a social conformity.
Hmm.
So it would look very different from the 50s, but I don't know. Does the 50s look like the Gilded Age, or does it look like, you know, the Washington administration? No, none of these things look similar at all.
It depends who you ask, because in 2016, that was depending on who you ask, that may or may not have been the great America to which Trump wanted to return us. And if you ask some other people, the 1950s were not so great for a lot of Americans.
Yeah.
I guess that's the other thing that I don't know if I explicitly said this or not, or just alluded to it, but there's a lot of rose-colored glasses and, you know, the victors write the history that certainly flows into this model here. And I don't know how you disentangle that, that's the job of professional historians. So presumably Strauss and Howe have good insight into that. But I could see that easily tinting their view of what these cycles look like. That it's very much colored by who won the fourth turning, and so
also they have
the ability to write the previous turnings the way they wanted.
They're very overly political and government focused, just because I believe they live in D.C. and are writing for a D.C. audience, and so that causes them to focus on things that wouldn't necessarily be my focus all the time. I mean, I love politics, as you know, but it's like, you know, I think a lot of the best stuff happens outside politics.
Presumably, people who are at the levers of power would be very interested in this type of thing,
and
so this could be valuable to them. Which raises the question, we are not sitting at the levers of power. We are not in D.C., or wherever the future capital of these United States might be. What do we do with this information? How do we use this in our daily life?
So, first of all, I'm going to go back to the example with the movies changing. Demon Children is in, now all of a sudden Demon Children is not in. So you could kind of use this even if you're not in politics, if you're just in marketing or sales or investing. You know, you can use some of this framework to try to anticipate where the future is going to go. Or, you know, what type of, for me, I'm going to think about this in terms of what type of technology to build, what type of consumer applications to invest in. I don't know what the takeaway is exactly in that, but I want to think about that a little more, because I think it does, there are lessons to be taken here on how to build a consumer app. Or not how to build a consumer app, but like what
consumers want.
What direction society is going to go in. Also, in terms of like preparing for more crises, because I think most people would agree with me that we're not out of the woods yet. There are definitely specific examples in the book of what you can do, but a lot of it is like, you know, have very close friend and family connections, make sure you have multiple sources of income, you know, all sorts of kind of good idea things that you should have during a crisis that are probably good practice anyway.
It sounds like we just started a Tom Woods commercial there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I could probably read some more stuff, but, you can get the book and give their takeaways. But I think some of the takeaways are that, like, hey, if there's going to be a bunch of upheaval in society, you know, I think then it's like, okay, there are things I could do to prepare personally. Could you have foreseen COVID? No, but if you were dependent on one thing for your income, I guess in some cases you might be in a position where there's not much you can do. But I guess everyone just does what they can.
And we've mentioned COVID at least once or twice now.
Yeah.
Another
thing in this book is like, that's why if COVID happened like 40 years ago, people have just been like, eh. Yeah, nothing. Because we are in a fourth turning mode, which is everything is an overreaction in the fourth turning. And I can't say I disagree with that prediction.
Well, I was just thinking that the previous pandemic that is most compared to COVID was the 1918 flu, which would have been in a third turning.
Right.
So very different from that perspective. But how different was the pandemic itself? So I think maybe that could be useful in thinking about how we reacted to it and the impact that it's had on us socially, politically, economically.
Yeah. I mean, so I don't generally look at that stuff in terms of the saeculum trends. I mean, just looking at it in terms of coming back to linear time, like we had modern times where, governments didn't really react to pandemics that much. Until recently, it seems like each one were reacting more and more. Individuals reacted to the 1918 pandemic. There were certainly masks, but it wasn't federal government didn't do anything, surprisingly, very little. So I don't know. There was a pandemic during the Revolutionary War that was a big concern, of course, but I think it was. What was it? Was it smallpox?
That would be period correct, but I don't recall.
Yeah. Okay. I don't. There could have been multiple ones. I don't know. But the reaction and policies put in place seem to be consistent with fourth turning. So again, who wins the fourth turning? Is it? I mean. Part of me says like, it could go so many different ways.
So like, this is maybe getting a little bit far afield.
What if critical race theory is the conformity that we're expected to go by in the first turning? Like, I don't know. That could happen.
Yeah. And I'm not really sure, how to prepare for that? What action you take there to thrive in that environment?
I mean, I don't know, but I don't know if there is a okay. What do you do if the fourth turning doesn't go your way? I guess the good thing about the first turning is you're kind of going to be allowed to just go back to work.
Yeah. I mean, so. Germany came out of the last cycle. They're strong now, but they had a long, hard road to
something like that could happen. Something that could happen.
I mean, it took them at least half of a saeculum to basically rebuild. I mean, I'd say that West Germany was doing
quarters.
Pretty well during the late Cold War, but then after the fall of the wall, it took them a while to reintegrate and get all that back up.
The East Side still had rubble from World War II.
Yeah.
Look, I actually don't think this thing is going to end that badly. If that's going to be positive. Oh, it's not going to end that badly. Oh, it could get pretty bad. No, I actually think that my running theory is that... the technologies that we're building in terms of Bitcoin, in terms of other kind of blockchain / decentralized technologies that are going around the gatekeeper. I think that, and yes, there's a little bit of a contradiction here where they're decentralized technology, but I think they're going to lead to the new institutions upon which the new social order will be created. And it could for a time be a more conformist social order, but it will be on top of a much stronger foundation that could lead to better social change in the next awakening.
So I'm sure there's a lot more we could say, but let's go out on that positive note.
Yeah, that's why I was trying to read it, because I wanted to go out on the positive note, and that's why I want to talk about that stuff a lot more on the podcast, because I kind of want to nudge things in that direction. If we can. And I will next week as well, because I'm talking to the founder of Odyssey, lives here in New Hampshire and is decentralizing YouTube. So that's very exciting. And this is not just, you know, YouTube clone. This is some really interesting technology that this is on top of. So I'm very excited to do that interview.
So exciting for the nerds among us, as well as the casual viewers of internet videos.
All right. Aaron, thanks a lot. I'm going to have to tell people on the video that the video went out. And if they want to hear about who won the fourth turning, they're going to have to listen
to the
podcast. Yeah. But I think it went pretty well. And we'll get this studio straightened out in no time.
Absolutely.
All right. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. To support The Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week.
Feel the power.